Kelly Egan awoke and sat up, slowly becoming aware of the faint smell of smoke. She threw back the covers and set her bare feet on the carpet. The carpet seemed abnormally warm. Concerned, she pulled a robe over her shoulders and padded across the floor to the door leading to the adjoining stateroom occupied by her father. Dr. Elmore Egan was in a deep sleep, as evidenced by his snoring. A Nobel Prize-winning mechanical genius, he was traveling on the Emerald Dolphin because she carried the revolutionary new engines that he had designed and developed, and he was making a study of how they were performing on their first voyage. Kelly leaned across his bed and shook him lightly by the shoulder. "Dad, wake up." A light sleeper, Egan came instantly awake. "What is it? Are you ill?"
"I smell smoke," Kelly answered, "and the floor feels hot."
Fully awake, Egan leaned out of bed and placed both palms on the carpet. He sniffed the air. "Get dressed," he said. "We're going on deck." On the A-deck shopping avenue, outside the wedding chapel, the crew was retreating in its battle against the fire. The portable extinguishers were used up. All the fire control systems were inoperative, and to add to their desperation, the hoses could not be attached because the valve caps were frozen closed and could not be removed by hand. It was as if they had been welded shut. To the men fighting the fire, frustration turned to terror as the situation worsened. With the fire doors unable to close, there was no way to isolate the blaze. McFerrin hailed the bridge.
"Tell the captain we're losing control down here. Is there any way the engine room can override the systems and close the fire doors?"
"Negative," answered Sheffield, anxiety obvious in his voice. "The entire fire control program is down. Computers, fire doors, sprinklers, the works. They've all failed."
"Why haven't you sounded the alarm?"
"I can't alarm the passengers without the captain's authority."
"Where is he?"
"He went down to judge the situation for himself. Haven't you seen him?"
Surprised, McFerrin searched the area but saw no sign of Waitkus.
"He's not here."
"Then he must be on his way back to the bridge," replied Sheffield, becoming uneasy.
"For the safety of the passengers, give the alarm and send them to their lifeboat stations in preparation for abandoning the ship."
Sheffield was aghast.
"Order 1,600 passengers to abandon the Emerald Dolphin? You're overreacting."
"For the love of God, man," McFerrin shouted. "Give the alarm and warn the passengers. Unless you can get the fire control systems operational in the next 5 minutes, this ship and everybody on it is doomed."
Bells clanged, and sirens whooped throughout the ship. Drugged by sleep, 1,600 passengers came awake, confused and questioning the harsh interruption. Dr. Egan had led his daughter to the observation deck on the upper section of the superstructure, where they could get an overall view of the ship. His worst fears were confirmed when he saw the conflagration rolling from amidships 7 decks below. On the stern, the crew was feverishly throwing canisters containing life rafts into the sea, where they were ejected and automatically inflated. He spoke sharply to Kelly.
"Go down to the open cafe on B deck and wait there. I must retrieve my papers from my stateroom. I'll be along in a few minutes."
Hordes of frightened passengers poured into every passage and companionway, every elevator. People who lived responsible and disciplined lives had suddenly become pitiful rabble, overcome with the fear of death. The crew, the officers, stewards, and stateroom stewardesses all did their best to control the chaos, but it was a lost cause. Without the haven of the lifeboats, there was no place for anyone to go but over the side into the water. Kelly pushed her way through the throng until she reached the railing, then hung onto it in a death grip. A woman was moaning hysterically.
"We'll be burned alive. I don't want to die in a fire."
Before anyone could stop her, she climbed over the rail and jumped into the sea. Kelly began to fear for her father. She was contemplating going back to their staterooms to look for him when he reappeared, carrying a brown leather case.
"Oh, Dad," she cried, "I was afraid I'd lost you."
"It's bedlam, absolute bedlam," he gasped, short of breath, his face flushed.
What can we do? She asked anxiously. Where can we go?
In the water, answered Egan. It's our only hope to stay alive as long as we can.
He looked solemnly into his daughter's eyes. They sparkled like blue sapphires when the light hit them just right. He could never help marveling at how much she looked like her mother, Lana, at the same age. Their height and weight and body shapes were identical, both tall, finely contoured. Kelly's long, straight, maple-sugar-brown hair, framing a strong face with high cheekbones, sculptured lips and perfect nose, were a mirror image, too. Both Kelly and her father had been devastated when Lana had died after a long battle with breast cancer. Now, as he stood there on the burning ship, his heart felt an indescribable heaviness at realizing that Kelly's own life was in dire jeopardy of being cut short. She smiled at him gamely. At least we're in the tropics, and the water will be warm enough for a swim. He squeezed her shoulders, and then looked down into the sea that was rushing past the great hull nearly 50 feet below. We'll wait until the absolute last minute before we go over, he said. There are bound to be ships coming to rescue us.